Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
In 1969, a plan to show support for an anti-racism protest turned the lives of 14 promising black student athletes upside down. Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story. Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is recorded at 14 hours GMT on Monday, the 5th of February. America's top diplomat begins another crisis tour of the Middle East, his fifth since the Gaza conflict began. Police in Senegal used tear gas against protesters angered by a delay to elections. And after clamping down on gang violence, President Nayib Bukele claims a record election victory in El Salvador. Also in the podcast, a new warning that famine could be returning to Ethiopia.
Thousands of people are not in a position to feed themselves and they are succumbing to death because of starvation. What transpired in 1985 would pale in comparison.
It is nearly 4 months since Hamas triggered the latest Gaza conflict by carrying out the massacre in southern Israel on the 7th of October. Since that day, the US Secretary of State Antony Blinken has visited the region four times. Now he is back, trying to persuade Israel to reduce civilian deaths in Gaza, to put pressure on Hamas to release more Israeli hostages, and to prevent a wider regional conflict. In the past 24 hours, Israel says it's killed dozens of Palestinian gunmen in Gaza. Tommaso Della Longa from the Red Cross says people caught up in the fighting there need more help.
There is still some light and some hope with the two border crossing open, the Kerem Shalom one and the Rafah border with Egypt. Now, the reality here is that it's still a drop in the ocean. We are speaking about more than 1,800,000 people internally displaced. Only 30% of the health facilities still working or barely working. So humanitarian needs are immense and the number of aid entering in the Gaza Strip is not at all enough.
Well, over the weekend, the US attacked Iranian-linked targets in Iraq and Syria, as well as the Houthis in Yemen. I spoke to our Middle East analyst Sebastian Usher and asked him what Antony Blinken will try to achieve on the visit as a whole and on his first stop in Saudi Arabia.
I mean, the message isn't that different from the one that he's brought in the previous visits he's made to the region since October the 7th, because essentially the situation hasn't changed. The Israeli offensive against Hamas hasn't shown any sign of easing. And although there have been some positive signals over a potential ceasefire and a new hostage deal, that hasn't yet resulted in anything that concrete. And even those who are talking it up most, like Qatar, which is one of the main mediators, have said that, you know, it could still be weeks before something like that happens. So, I mean, what Antony Blinken is trying to do is to show that the US is still very much trying to play a leading role in what happens as the key ally for Israel. It's continued to support Israel's right to what it sees as a self-defense, but it has increasingly said that it's unhappy about the way that Israel is carrying out this in the numbers of civilians that have been killed. That message in Saudi Arabia will be slightly also to do with the Saudis themselves. Although they're not the most active participants by any means in mediation efforts, it has huge influence across the region, and it was about or close to signing a potential normalisation deal with Israel. Saudi Arabia hasn't ruled that out, but it's raised its price over that. It's at times saying that it wants a clear, irrevocable path towards a two-state solution, though more recently it's downplayed that slightly, saying it just wants much more concerted progress if it's to make that deal. So he'll be discussing what comes after what's going on in Gaza as well as what's going on now.
Yeah, on the subject of Gaza, as well as the people dying, the US is also concerned about the humanitarian needs of those who are still alive. What is the latest from Israel's offensive? What is life like for people in Gaza, southern Gaza in particular, at the moment?
Well, the situation there, I mean, this is where hundreds of thousands of Gazans have essentially fled from their homes further north, many of whom have now moved several times, each time further south to places that Israel said are secure. Now attention, I mean, it's been on Khan Yunis, the main city down in the south. That offensive continues. That's what Israel believes, that much of Hamas leadership still holds out. But it's also going towards Rafah, the city which is right on the border with Egypt, which was seen as the place where people would be safe. We're hearing this morning that there's artillery fire that's been heard in the east of Rafah. So that's a really major concern we've seen out of the past few days. But Israel seems to be concentrating on what might happen in Rafah now.
Our Middle East analyst, Sebastian Usher. For 2 years, the Tigray region of Ethiopia was engulfed by fighting between the Tigray People's Liberation Front and the central Ethiopian government, backed by allies from Eritrea. 14 months on, there are growing fears of a famine in the region, with the latest warning coming from a visiting British government minister. Andrew Mitchell said there was every danger that Ethiopia would be engulfed by famine unless urgent action was taken. The Ethiopian government says almost 16 million people are short of food. Getachew Reda is head of the interim regional administration of Tigray.
The one thing I know is that thousands of people who would otherwise have been able to feed themselves are not in a position to feed themselves, and they are succumbing to death because of starvation. Whether you call it famine or a risk of famine or a potential famine, for me, it's purely academic.
Our diplomatic correspondent, James Landale, travelled with Mr. Mitchell to Ethiopia and told me about their visit.
What we've seen is a mixed picture. Nobody really knows what's going on on the ground because there are parts of Ethiopia that are just inaccessible. It's hard to get, you know, media access. There are areas that there is still some fighting going on. There are some areas that are still occupied by Eritrean forces. So it's hard for international agencies to get there. So the picture that has been built up is one of sort of a compound anecdotal evidence of reports coming in from different towns and villages and regions. And what we learnt is we went to one clinic in a place called Agulai, which is north of the Tigrayan capital, Mekele. And there we talked to the nurses who were checking all the children that had been brought in by the mothers for malnutrition. And the nurses there told us that all the numbers were going up. They keep very, very tight control. They have a lot of mothers bringing their children in on a fairly regular basis to try and get some kind of support, some kind of food into their children. And they're measuring all the time. And we had a look at their charts, and the charts are going up. We also went to a hospital in Mekele, and the doctors there told us that the numbers of admissions of children with severe acute malnutrition had doubled since the war began in 2020. And even though the war is over, those numbers are not coming down.
Yeah, over more than a year ago. But is this potential famine, the result of the fighting that we saw then?
The fighting is one of the reasons. What you've got is an awful confluence of two evils. One is successive droughts in parts of Ethiopia that have meant that, you know, just crops have failed season after season. Many people attribute this to climate change. That's one factor. But then also, as you say, the fighting. Although there was a ceasefire over a year ago, despite that, there are still, it's estimated, about 4 million people in Ethiopia who are still displaced from their homes. They can't go back because their homes are still occupied by other forces and militias. And so they are sitting in camps. And they are economically unproductive. They can't go back to their homes to try and, you know, grow their own food and become more resilient. So if you add those two things together, you've got a fairly difficult economic situation here. So government budgets are going down. You've got the international community distracted by the Middle East and Ukraine. Last year, international aid was suspended also for 5 months because it emerged that huge amounts of aid was being siphoned off by the army. So those things together are what are fueling this crisis. And as you say, people are saying that if the international community does not act, then it will get worse.
James Landale in Ethiopia. The president of the Central American nation of El Salvador says it is a record in the entire democratic history of the world. Nayib Bukele claims to have won re-election with 85% of the vote, even though official results have not been released. Mr. Bukele would be the first president to serve a second consecutive term in El Salvador since the end of military rule more than four decades ago. Opinion polls suggest he is popular as a result of his war on gangs, but he's faced criticism over human rights violations. Our correspondent Will Grant reports from El Salvador.
To chance of five more years from his supporters outside, President Bukele cast his ballot in a polling station in San Salvador. And from the start, there's been little doubt that he will indeed be granted exactly that in this election, another five-year term. His re-election bid has been criticised by his critics for having been approved by loyalists that he appointed to the Supreme Court's constitutional chamber. Yet it seems most voters didn't care and simply wanted to see him remain in power. In large part, he's won their support for a draconian gang crackdown he ordered 2 years ago, which has seen some 75,000 people arrested, but which has transformed the security situation in El Salvador. At a news conference after voting, Mr. Bukele dismissed human rights concerns over his security policy.
El Salvador was turned from the most dangerous place in the world to the safest in the Western Hemisphere. That's not a small feat.
The vote itself appeared to go off peacefully around the country, with very few reports of any irregularities.
I'm in a voting centre in Quetzaltepeque, just about half an hour outside San Salvador. And this is where the leader of the left-wing FMLN party cast his ballot a little earlier. There is a steady stream of voters coming in and an atmosphere of calm and security. Uneventful, if you like, in a good way.
In the run-up to the vote, Mr. Bukele's rivals were always a distant second. One of them was the FMLN's candidate, Manuel Flores.
We're seeing, not just on social media, but among the people, that the direction this country is heading is going to change, and it will bring happiness, enthusiasm, and dynamism. It's going to take young people from a place of darkness to one of strength.
By and large, Bukele supporters were calling for an extension of the military-led security crackdown, while the president's opponents voted over what they see as worsening authoritarianism.
Before, we couldn't move around easily through fear. Fear of being physically hurt. But now we have this president who is governing in the way that God intends.
In a democracy, I'm not sure about all these things the president's been doing in his first term. I don't want him to have a second term. It's unconstitutional. He'll be an unconstitutional president.
With a huge majority in his favour, President Bukele will feel more endorsed and stronger than ever in his position. In a second term, he will need to tackle difficult questions of where his controversial security policy goes from here and how to revitalise the economy. For now, though, his supporters are just thankful that he'll be El Salvador's president for a second term with an unprecedented level of support.
Now to Senegal, where people are angry at President Macky Sall's decision to delay the election. Riot police in Senegal fired tear gas at protesters outside parliament in the capital, Dakar. These demonstrators denounced the postponement.
They're planning on keeping power for another 6 months. It's just a beginning. They're going to go on and on and on and on. Everything we want is a fair election. Election, that's all we want.
We deserve freedom. We have been a peaceful country, democratic country, and this president is not allowed to take our freedom.
Well, the authorities also cut mobile phone and internet access. Our Africa regional editor Richard Hamilton is following developments.
So the latest is that about 100 people had gathered outside the National Assembly, and the army had sent in tanks and riot police, as you say, used tear gas to disperse the protesters. And the internet was cut. The communications minister said this was to stop the dissemination of hateful and subversive messages on social media amid a context of threats of disturbances to public order. So they clearly wanted to stop people organising more protests, as there had been on Sunday, which had turned quite violent and one opposition politician was arrested. The cutting of the internet has been condemned by the local branch of Amnesty International, and it seems that this political crisis is just getting worse and worse.
Yeah, why have the elections been postponed?
So it's quite complicated, but President Macky Sall had been in power for two terms, and he had long delayed announcing whether he would run for a third term. And this caused a lot of uncertainty, and there were a lot of protests by the opposition. And then in July, he said he wouldn't run for a third term, and everyone sort of breathed a sigh of relief, and this was widely welcomed. But then there was this shock announcement on Saturday saying that the poll, which was due on the 25th of February, would be delayed. And he didn't really give very clear reasons, but it's thought to be a dispute between the National Assembly and the Constitutional Court over the eligibility of candidates. And on Saturday, Macky Sall said, "I will begin an open national dialogue to bring together the conditions for a free, transparent and inclusive election." But he didn't really go into the details of why he took this decision. But critics are saying that he wasn't sure that his nominated successor, Amadou Ba, who's the prime minister, would actually win this election. So in effect, he's just pulled the plug. And critics are calling it a constitutional coup. Now, some of the main candidates that are not allowed to run are the son of the former president, Karim Wade, so he's the son of Abdoulaye Wade, and the Constitutional Court had rejected his candidacy, saying that he was half French. And then the other very popular opposition figure is Ousmane Sonko, who's prevented from running as well. And he says that various court cases against him are politically motivated.
Our Africa regional editor, Richard Hamilton. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
I would love to tell you that this is the best moment of my life, but I feel this happy when I finish a song.
Taylor Swift wins Album of the Year at the Grammys for a record fourth time.
You've heard of Charlie Chaplin, right? Well, Charlie Chaplin was my grandfather, and there was a time when he was the biggest star in all the world. But something happened, not just to him, but to hundreds of artists in Hollywood. They were forced to leave, forced out.
I'm Una Chaplin, and from CBC Podcasts and the BBC World Service, this is Hollywood Exiles. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.
After several difficult years, diplomatic relations between Australia and China were on the mend following a high-profile visit to Beijing in November by the Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese. But there is renewed tension after an Australian blogger was sentenced to death. The Chinese-born Yang Hongjun was arrested on espionage charges on a rare trip back to China 5 years ago. The sentence, announced 3 years after a secret trial, will be commuted to life in prison if no further crimes are committed. But the writer is ill at the moment. Elaine Pearson from the campaign group Human Rights Watch criticised the verdict.
This is really an outrageous sentencing, that someone could be given a suspended death sentence. What we've seen in this case is myriad due process violations from start to finish. Yang himself has alleged torture, forced confessions, particularly in the earlier period of interrogations. He had delayed access to legal representation, limited access to a lawyer. Australian diplomats were also prevented from entering the courtroom.
Well, China said Australia's consular rights were respected and that the case had been tried in strict accordance with the law. Our Beijing correspondent, Stephen McDonnell, told me what he made of the sentence and its timing.
Well, certainly the sentence, when the family, if you ask the family what their attitude to the sentence is, shocked and devastated by the news, which they described as at the extreme end of worst expectations. So he's been given the harshest of possible penalties, and you wonder what it is that he's supposed to have done to warrant this. Now, Yang Hongjun, Australian citizen, born in China and previously worked for the Chinese government years ago. So I guess when it comes to the state security apparatus here, they seem as a bit of a traitor. And I think, you know, they're known to be very hard line. And so 5 years after him initially being picked up, he's finally sentenced. And they wouldn't care less about the impact it has on China-Australia relations, because for them, I guess, getting tough is the natural response to this type of thing. But you'd have to wonder what the Chinese government does from here on in, because it is going to really hurt China-Australia relations again.
Yeah, I mean, is it a case of back to square one for those relations which were slowly warming?
Well, neither side's going to want that, but, you know, I mean, if you've got someone there who the Australian government has clearly been calling for this person to be released, and then they're given a death sentence, a suspended death sentence, but nevertheless a death sentence, I don't know if it'll go back to where it was, but certainly it's going to put tensions back on things, that's for sure.
Now, young Han Jun had been detained in China before and released back in 2011 after representations from Australia. I mean, one wonders why he returned there after he'd been so outspoken against the Chinese authorities.
Yeah, well, it's a very good question, and some would say, really, he shouldn't have gone back there. I guess after he was released that time, possibly he thought everything's okay again. He's, you know, writing these blogs, he's criticising the Chinese government over human rights abuses and what have you, and the fact that he was released once, he must have thought, well, it's all okay then. And after all, he's Chinese, he wants to go back to his homeland to visit friends and family, but as it turned out, it was the wrong thing for him to have done, because now, after 5 years in prison, apparently his health is really deteriorating, and his family say it even could potentially be life-threatening. They're worried that he could die in jail after this.
Stephen McDonnell in Beijing. The European Centre for Particle Research, CERN, is already home to the world's biggest atom smasher, the Large Hadron Collider. Now it wants to build a new machine that will be three times larger. Our science correspondent, Palab Ghosh, has been to visit.
Wow.
This is it. This is the Atlas experiment, or as I mentioned, a very small section of it.
Welcome to the Atlas detector, 100 metres below Geneva.
It's huge.
It's massive.
Jamie Pennell is showing me a metal cylinder the size of a shipping tanker.
This detector is 42 metres long, it's 26 metres wide, and we're in a cavern 30 metres wide. No, that does not leave a lot of room for us. This is actually the world's largest ship in a bottle when it comes to assembling all of this together.
Atlas is one of four huge underground detectors, joined by an even more gigantic tube. Together they make up the world's largest particle accelerator, the Large Hadron Collider, or LHC for short.
In the map we see the future circular collider.
It's so much
layout.
Bigger.
Yes.
It's so much bigger.
It's three times bigger.
On the surface, CERN's Director General, Professor Fabiola Ginotti, tells me that she needs an even larger particle accelerator.
We need a larger collider because there are so many outstanding questions in fundamental physics today and in our knowledge of the universe, its structure and its evolution, for which we have no answer. And so we need more powerful instruments to be able to address those questions.
These bottles, 15 years of history, but these bottles are representing milestones.
At the LHC's control room, Professor Rende Stenberg shows me a row of 100 bottles of champagne and wine, each one celebrating a landmark discovery. And in amongst them is a solitary bottle of whiskey.
Let me take one of these bottles. So if I take this bottle here...
So that's the Higgs?
That's the Higgs single malt, distilled in Edinburgh, matured at CERN.
The Higgs boson was detected in 2012 and was the LHC's biggest breakthrough. The Higgs is a particle that gives everything in the universe its mass and form, but its discovery didn't answer what most of the universe is made of. The particles we know about explain how only 5% of the universe works, which is why Professor Giannotti says she needs a larger machine.
95% of the universe being a question mark, it's something big. We are missing something big.
Her proposal is to build what's called the FCC, the Future Circular Collider, next to the existing accelerator. It'll be at least twice as deep and 91 kilometres around. That's three times the circumference. The extra distance means that the particles inside will have more energy and so crash into each other even harder. Back at the experiments underground, Professor Mitesh Patel of Imperial College London tells me that this increases the chances of discovering those particles that make up the missing 95% of the universe.
We will have a complete revolution. We will find something that doesn't really fit in the picture that we thought it should do, and that will result in us completely overturning our understanding of how all of it sits together.
There seem to be kind of cracks appearing in this kind of wonderful model.
I'm excited about the cracks appearing. The cracks, we hope, will turn into chasms.
The FCC isn't a done deal. Planners have to prove that it can be built with minimal environmental disruption. And then there's a cost, around 20 billion euros for the initial phase, a price tag that CERN's 70 member nations will have to decide whether they can afford. But the researchers here feel that they're within reach of finding the new particles that really make the universe tick. One more heave, they say, and they could make one of the biggest breakthroughs of all time.
Pallab Ghosh reporting from CERN. At least 10 police officers have been killed after militants stormed a police station in the northwest of Pakistan. The attack, involving hand grenades and sniper fire, comes as violence escalates ahead of the general election on Thursday. Our correspondent in Islamabad, Caroline Davis, gave me the details.
We know that this attack happened at around 3 o'clock in the morning, according to the deputy superintendent there. As you say, the militants came in firstly using sniper fire. They then used grenades once they got inside the building, which we understand then caused more injuries and more death as well. Now, apparently, according to the superintendent, there was an exchange of fire between the militants and between the police, which lasted over 2.5 hours. The police now say that they have got the police station back, but at one stage they did lose control of it to the militant group. 10 police officers have been killed. We were told directly by this deputy superintendent that 9 have been injured. The key thing at this stage is that we don't know who has carried out the attack. We haven't seen a claim yet. The area has seen attacks before. Quite often security forces are targeted, so army, police, by militant groups, quite often by Islamic State or affiliates of Islamic State or the Pakistani Taliban or affiliates of the Pakistani Taliban and other militant groups too. As I say, we don't know who is claiming this particular attack at the moment. The Pakistani Taliban at the moment seem to be distancing themselves from it, but we're keeping an eye to see who will come forward and say that they were responsible.
So do we know if it's related to the election, and whether it is or not, are the authorities taking action to prevent further violence ahead of that vote?
So the elections are happening from Thursday onwards. It's very difficult to know without knowing who carried this out, to know for certain whether this was related to the election. And we didn't get anything from the police directly saying that, but we have seen a rise in violence in the run-up to the elections. On Wednesday, there was actually another attack as well on a National Assembly candidate who was shot dead. There were attacks that have happened in Balochistan, including at an election office, and a bomb attack that happened at a political rally. The police and the authorities have said that they are going to make sure that there is strong security, particularly on election day as well. First line of defence is police based at stations, but we also understand that the military will be involved as well, trying to provide additional protection to give people some form of security, because obviously in a run-up to an election, people don't feel safe voting. That has a major effect on how free and fair these elections are seen as being.
Caroline Davis in Pakistan. One of Australia's most respected Aboriginal leaders, Luija O'Donoghue, has died at the age of 91. She spent her life advocating for the health and rights of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. Celia Hatton looks back at her life.
Luija O'Donoghue was taken from her Aboriginal mother by the authorities at the age of 2 and placed in care, forbidden to speak her own language or to ask about her background. At 18, she fought to become a nurse. She excelled in the nursing profession, but her life changed when she was recognised by some Aboriginal patients and finally learned about her own family, meeting her mother again more than 30 years after she'd been taken. She then devoted her life advocating for the health and rights of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and was celebrated as Australian of the Year in 1984.
Celia Hatton on Luija O'Donoghue, who's died at the age of 91. Taylor Swift has made history at the Grammys, becoming the first artist to win Album of the Year for a fourth time. The night was dominated by female artists, as Emma Vardy reports from the red carpet.
It's the 66th annual Grammy Awards, and tonight we're coming to you live from the city of Los Angeles, where the local population has just survived the unthinkable, rain.
As a storm battered LA, there was shelter for the stars on the red carpet, while inside the arena, the awards rained down for female artists.
Started to cry, then remembered, I just won my first Grammy!
Miley Cyrus picked up 2 Grammys for her hit Flowers and gave the crowd a little more than they bargained for.
Thank you all so much. I don't think I forgot anyone, but I might have forgotten underwear. Bye!
While it was Billie Eilish who won Song of the Year with her hit What Was I Made For from the Barbie soundtrack.
I for not one second changed my course.
It's rare an awards ceremony goes off without a little controversy, and Jay-Z used his speech to criticise the Recording Academy for repeatedly failing to give the top prize Album of the Year to his wife Beyoncé as he picked up the Dr. Dre Global Impact Award.
I don't want to embarrass this young lady, but she has more Grammys than everyone and never won Album of the Year. So even by your own metrics, that doesn't work.
SZA was the most nominated artist going into the Grammys, and she won three, including Best R&B Song for Snooze.
I came really, really far, and I can't believe this is happening, and it feels very fake. And I'm like, hi, Taylor. I love you.
And there was a lot more love for Taylor Swift, who won Album of the Year for Midnights, becoming the first artist in history to win the top prize four times, putting her beyond the three-time winners Frank Sinatra, Stevie Wonder and Paul Simon.
I would love to tell you that this is the best moment of my life, but I feel this happy when I finish a song or when I crack the code to a bridge that I love or when I'm shot-listing a music video or when I'm rehearsing with my dancers or my band or getting ready to go to Tokyo to play a show. For me, the award is the work.
What now?
Mind blown. Thank you so much.
Strange. They shake their heads and say, Johnny, you've changed.
This was a moment many fans never thought they'd see. Joni Mitchell performing for the first time at the Grammys at 80 years old. A remarkable comeback after almost losing her life to a brain aneurysm. With major wins and powerful performances, this was a Grammys in which women were centre stage across several generations.
Joni Mitchell ending that report by Emma Vardy. And that is all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Martin Baker and produced by Stephanie Tillotson. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.
With Dash Pass from DoorDash, get more to your door for less. Groceries, self-care, restaurants, and snacks. With no delivery fees and savings on every order. Dash that with Dash Pass from DoorDash. Start your 30-day free trial now. Terms and conditions apply.